The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The most recent editions available are from the archives, November 24, 2025, and November 10, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. And the November 24, 2025 edition shows a woman. Her face is actually strangely colored in green and orange, but she's looking at eyeglasses, and that itself is modified by a surgically implanted chip, and she was sightless. And now, with the assistance of this surgically implanted chip, she can see. Time is in capital lettering, large print, white, upon this black border with the woman's face in the rather neon-colored orange and green. The first article from that edition is from the Time Off section, Breaking Good, by Judy Berman. Vince Gilligan knows better than to try to explain where his stories come from, like the extraterrestrial transmission that kicks off his new Apple TV series, Pluribus. Their origin is a mystery, but the writer, producer, and director, best known for creating the era-defining crime drama Breaking Bad, can approximate where and when he started mulling the idea for the sci-fi epic that would become his first major project since leaving the Walter White universe. It was probably 2016 in Burbank, California, where Gilligan had convened the writer's room for season 3 of Better Call Saul, the Breaking Bad spinoff he created with Peter Gould. "We would take lunch breaks that seemed to stretch longer and longer," he recalls. "I'd walk around the neighborhood and my mind would wander." His thoughts coalesced around the concept of wish fulfillment. "I thought, what if everyone in the world was suddenly really, really nice to me?" When he took himself out of the scenario, the question became, why would one guy be that interesting to people? The answer forms the wild premises of Pluribus, which premiered November 7, and whose particulars are best discovered as the show unfolds. But as for that irresistibly interesting guy, well, he turned out not to be a guy at all. Gilligan recruited Rhea Seehorn, who earned 2 Emmy nominations for playing Saul's beloved Kim Wexler, to anchor the show as his first female protagonist, Carol Sturka. Despite press materials that introduce Carol as the most miserable person on earth, she's also his first bona fide hero. For a creator synonymous with the rise of anti-hero television, who made his name telling what he famously called a story about a man who transforms himself from Mr. Chips into Scarface, this is a seismic shift. Yet it is also a reflection of the keen moral sensibility that's always permeated Gilligan's work. Though he remains proud of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, both of which aired on AMC, the once avowedly apolitical storyteller has become convinced that pop culture's recent supersaturation with anti-heroes has been unhealthy for society. His most ambitious series to date, Pluribus, can be seen as a corrective of sorts, a grand, artful, mind-bendingly philosophical darkly funny, sometimes heartbreaking, but consistently humane vindication of our fractious species. When Gilligan reflects on his trajectory from a kid making Super 8 movies in the Richmond, Virginia area to, at 58, one of TV's most acclaimed creators, the word that keeps coming up is luck. I really feel like I'm the Kramer of the TV writing world, he said in October at a boutique hotel in New York City. I fell ass backward into good luck time and time again. This self-assessment undersells the talent of a man who's made two of the medium's best dramas, but rather than false modesty, it reads as the genuine humility of a guy who reflexively credits his collaborators. It is about a month before Pluribus is slated to debut, and Gilligan, who lives in New Mexico, his new show, like the Breaking Bad universe, is set in Albuquerque, is in town for press and a preview screening during New York Comic Con. Dressed in a bright blue t-shirt that matches the hotel room's azure and white decor, in an accidental echo of the meticulous production design for which his series are known, he speaks largely in anecdotes with a soft southern twang. As if to mark a new phase of his career, he has shaved the goatee that was his signature throughout the AMC years. He has been through several eras already. Gilligan was studying film at NYU when in 1989 he won the Virginia Governor's Screenwriting Award for the script that would become the movie Home Fries. He spent the next few years writing features, but by 1994 that work was drying up. He was broke. When his agent got him a meeting with the X-Files creator, Chris Carter, Gilligan only intended to compliment him, but Carter asked for ideas. Gilligan pitched an episode about a character whose shadow came to life, and his future boss hired him on the spot to write it. Gilligan's three-decade tenure in TV has paralleled the evolution of the medium. In the 90s, broadcast networks dominated prime time with mega hits like Seinfeld, ER, and The X-Files, whose viewership on Fox peaked at a now inconceivable 20 million. Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul emerged into what has been called the third golden age of television. A renaissance in audacious cinematic cable programming, spurred by the success of The Sopranos and sustained by Netflix's need to build a streaming library. Now he's making Pluribus for Apple, one of the few companies still reliably funding expensive streaming series at a time of consolidation and austerity in Hollywood. And yet Gilligan initially doubted he could make it as a TV writer. "The thing I was most trepidatious about is I'm so lazy," he says. Surely, he figured, a guy whose process involved frequent video game breaks would not last past his 13-week X-Files probation. "I thought I don't really need to clean out my fridge in Virginia. The ketchup will keep 13 weeks." But he took to the hard work. "The two things about TV that are so great," he discovered, "are that your writing actually gets produced. Unlike film scripts, which can take years to reach the screen, if they do at all, and working with smart, talented people you can stand to be in a room with for 12 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week." Gilligan counts himself, yes, lucky to have been pitching Breaking Bad amid a boom in cable networks making bespoke scripted series, an escape hatch from broadcast's grueling 22-plus episode seasons. The 2008 premiere of the show, which follows a terminally ill teacher, Bryan Cranston, who cooks meth to stockpile money for his family, failed to generate the same buzz as AMC's flagship original, Mad Men. A 2011 New York Times Magazine profile ventured in an observation that has aged awkwardly, that Gilligan might be TV's first true red state auteur. Just when it looked as if that crowd might not be enough to sustain it, Netflix licensed the show, driving millions of new viewers to AMC for new episodes. Breaking Bad not only ended its five-season run with a record-shattering 10.3 million viewers tuning in for Walter White's Shakespearean send-off, but also yielded a more ruminative companion show in Saul about Walt's crooked lawyer, Bob Odenkirk, and a feature-length Netflix sequel, El Camino, that followed Walt's puppyish partner in crime, Jesse Pinkman, Aaron Paul. Gilligan is not wrong that he benefited from serendipitous timing, yet it is equally true that none of Breaking Bad's rivals maintained both the huge audiences and the consistent quality of what became Basic Cable's crown jewel of the 2010s. He did not take the challenge of crafting his first female protagonist lightly. While Kim was so popular that viewers lived in fear she would be killed off, Walt's wife Skyler, played by Anna Gunn, was widely despised for her perceived shrillness. "I always worry about writing female characters," he says, "a lesbian character as well, because that's not my experience. But women are well represented among the series' writers and directors. Besides, what makes Carol, like Kim, a great character is that she is not defined by gender or sexuality. She is a person first." It does not feel like he had an agenda of, "I'm going to write a female empowerment story." He wrote a fascinating, complex, incredibly reluctant hero with a lot of flaws, but a lot of strengths, some of which she did not know she had. Only in hindsight did he realize that her anxious, misanthropic tendencies, standard writer problems, mirrored his own. In 2016, the news broke that Gilligan was developing a drama about the Jonestown Massacre. But the project never got off the ground. He found himself paralyzed by the task of doing justice to the victims without elevating the perspective of their leader. "I realized I better stay in my lane," he says. "I'm better at making up stories. Then I don't have to feel responsible for dramatizing real people's pain." As adaptations and franchises crowd out the original storytelling on TV, Gilligan is notable for what he does not do as well as what he does. You're not likely to find him helming the next Andor or The Penguin or any other prestige-branded series based on monolithic IP. We've got modern mythologies now with Star Wars and Star Trek and Marvel and DC, and all that stuff's great, he allows. But that stuff was created for people who are now in their 60s and 70s. It's good that they continue. It shows they have a fundamental worth in terms of myth. But, he says, every generation deserves its own mythology. Standing before a crowd of peers in February to accept a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Writers Guild, Gilligan argued that pop culture needed to move on from bad guys like Walter White. "We're living in an era where bad guys, the real-life kind, are running amok," he says. "Bad guys who make their own rules. Bad guys who, no matter what they tell you, are only out for themselves. Who am I talking about? Well, this is Hollywood, so guess." It was time, he believed, for heroes to make a comeback. Gilligan's been expressing similar sentiments since at least 2018. What changed to make a creator who spent the better part of the Obama years cultivating his own Scarface nostalgia for Mr. Chips? Gilligan does not mention names, but Donald Trump took office in 2017, so guess. I've been studiously apolitical my whole career, he says, because he found that polemic instantly turned off half the potential audience. Breaking Bad and Saul were concerned with larger moral truths. At their heart, both say actions have consequences. Simple though it is, Gilligan points out that this message eluded TV for years. As characters in the episodic fare that predominated before DVR and streaming enabled serialized storytelling could commit murder in one episode and never speak of it again. Now he feels compelled to re-examine the kind of characters he's creating because what's going on does not seem like it's about left or right anymore. It's about maintaining a democracy, a civil republic, and the rule of law, and the right to free speech versus giving it all away. Though it seems to him as if the U.S. is right on the edge of civil war, he is convinced that no one actually desires that outcome. We have got to find a way to talk to each other, he says. He's as stumped as anyone on how to make that happen, but he hopes Pluribus, a show too removed from our reality to explicitly address current politics that is nonetheless about people struggling to do the right thing, can play a small part in facilitating those conversations. The series captures the loneliness that's pervaded society since the COVID pandemic, and the dread of a future in which artificial intelligence might render human interaction obsolete. Gilligan did not have LLMs in mind when he conceived Pluribus, but says he's happy if this show in any way, shape, or form could turn people off to AI. In The Imperfect Hero, who is Carol, viewers get a role model who does not let her anger or grief stop her from trying to save the world. Gilligan is probably incapable of saccharine. Pluribus is as dry, ironic, brutal, and alert to the horrors festering in no small number of human souls as anything he has made. Yet Carol's quest becomes kind of inspiring. This reflects not just Seahorn's charm and Gilligan's frustrations with antiheroes, but also his anxiety about the prevalence of post-apocalyptic sci-fi stories. It was like it was priming people for the apocalypse instead of priming them to avoid the apocalypse at all cost, he says. Distilled to its essence, the message of Pluribus might be, humanity is worth fighting for. By the time Pluribus premiered, Gilligan would be back in the writer's room at work on a second season that was greenlighted along with the first. Does it bother him he won't get to hear audience feedback first? No, he says, because I don't think that's the job. Ever since The X-Files became one of the first shows to engage the internet, he has avoided fan chatter. Fellow writers would say, you need to check out this chat room. They're talking about your episode, he recalls. I instinctively knew to never do that. Now, not that he is closed off to all input. He never ever shuts me down, Seahorn says. And as meticulous as he is in constructing his richly detailed stories, Gilligan also values spontaneity. Breaking Bad lore is littered with a major plot changes made on the fly, and characters as key as Jesse kept around much longer than Gilligan intended because he liked the performances so much. He has a clearer sense of how he wants to wrap up Pluribus than he did for previous shows at this point in their runs, but makes no guarantees he'll stick to it. I want to stay open to the possibilities of going a different way, Gilligan explains. It's like if you get in your car and say, I'm in Virginia. I want to head out to California. So I know basically the direction I need to head. But there's all these side trips and back roads you can take along the way, and that makes the trip more exciting. Luck is part of that ride. You may get a flat tire or run into a long-lost friend at a rest stop. But if the destination's appealing and the driver's adept, the journey is bound to be worth taking. That article was slightly abridged. Here's a short review in the Time Off Review section, movies. George Clooney is quietly touching in a deeply meta role by Stephanie Zakarik. 1 minute a man is a hot young movie star, the next he's a silver fox. Who knows where the time goes? There are lots of movies about aging actresses. Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve are prime examples, but we're supposed to assume growing older does not faze men as much. It's easier for a man to ease into a state of sexy gravitas. That's true of both George Clooney and the George Clooney-like character he plays in Noah Baumbach's J. Kelly, which hit select theaters November 14 before streaming on Netflix December 5. You could not find a more fitting performer for this successful actor who, after an encounter with an old friend that begins with reminiscing and ends in a fistfight, reconsiders his entire life. The idea gives Clooney lots to work with. He gets to razzle-dazzle 1 minute and brood over his mistakes the next. Clooney can do it all. Yet there's something strangely inert about J. Kelly. That's J-A-Y space, K-E-L-L-Y. Baumbach co-wrote the script with Emily Mortimer, who also shows up in a few brief scenes. While a handful of moments are beautifully written, acted, and directed, J. Kelly feels more sentimental than truly thoughtful, particularly in the motif that resounds in Jay's brain. Why didn't I spend more time with my kids? Jay has two, an older daughter, Riley Key, who harbors bitterness toward him, and a younger one, Grace Edwards, who understands him better, though she is heading off to college. His only true friend is the guy who gets a 15% cut of everything he earns, his manager, Ron, played superbly by Adam Sandler. Is that really a friend at all? He and Ron confront that question, and the answer makes neither of them happy. Alienated from his daughters, Jay is delighted when he runs into an old acting school friend, Billy Crudup's Timothy. Timothy, now a child psychiatrist, heaps praise on his old friend. Then Timothy turns on him. In interviews, Jay has told a story about accidentally getting his first big role because he tagged along on a friend's audition. Timothy was that friend, and in his view, Jay used him. "You stole my life," he says, and Jay is crestfallen. He may be oblivious, but he is not cruel. There's plenty to dig into there, but before you know it, J. Kelly's off to the next thing. This is a restless Wrigley movie. There's the film festival in Tuscany that wants to honor Jay. Jay says no, then changes his mind when he realizes his younger daughter will be in Europe then. The movie's packed with supporting actors who show up for a scene or two, including Jim Broadbent as the benevolent director who gave Jay his big break, Alba Rohrwacher as a charming festival golfer, Greta Gerwig as Ron's harried wife, and Stacy Keach as Jay's difficult father. Laura Dern shows up as Jay's frustrated publicist. She and Sandler have the best scene in the movie, reflecting on the time they almost got together forever. Clooney's J. Kelly is the beaming, brooding star at the center of this constellation. As much light as he gives off, he soaks up more from those around him. He needs them in a way they do not need him. Clooney makes you care about a man who may be pretty much empty. When he finally gets to that tribute in Tuscany, he sits with the audience as they watch the laudatory assemblage of film clips drawn from his career. Only it's snapshots from Clooney's career we're seeing, clips from Michael Clayton, The Thin Red Line, even 2020's The Midnight Sky, in which Clooney plays a loner scientist with a big gray beard. We watch him watching himself. This is not just Jay Kelly watching Jay Kelly, but George Clooney watching George Clooney in roles where he looks impossibly young, a baby movie star taking his first steps. The look on his face, on Jay's face, on Clooney's face, is one of pure wonder. Who is that person? He seems to be asking himself, enchanted and seduced by his own image. It is the best visual question mark in a movie filled with unanswerable questions. The brief opener, after a year in the political wilderness, Democrats rode frustration over high prices and President Donald Trump's disruptive economic policies to win a raft of elections across the country November 4. In Virginia and New Jersey, voters handed the party the keys to the governor's mansions by larger-than-expected margins. In California, voters overwhelmingly approved new congressional districts to benefit Democrats after Texas passed its own new map to favor the GOP. But it was a series of decisive victories and down-ballot races against Republican incumbents that stunned leaders in both parties and bolstered Democrats' hopes that they had landed on a viable playbook for next year's midterm elections. That would be now this year's midterm elections. Pennsylvanians voted to keep three justices backed by Democrats on the state Supreme Court. Democrats in Georgia won two utility commission seats by double digits. The widest margins Democrats have seen in statewide contests there in two decades. In Mississippi, where absentee ballots were still being counted days later, Democrats appeared poised to flip two seats in the state Senate, breaking a GOP supermajority. In the wake of months of polls showing much of the electorate was dissatisfied with both parties, the initial response from many Democrats at running the table in such a hodgepodge of contests was a mixture of jubilation and disbelief. Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin said the Democrats are now full steam ahead to take back the Congress next year, meaning this year, as the party of affordability. Republicans are scrambling to chart their own path forward. The party has a year to show it's making a difference on the issues the electorate cares about most, says Whit Ayers, a longtime GOP strategist. He called the margins of victories voters gave to governors-elect Abigail Spanberger in Virginia and Mickey Sherrill in New Jersey pretty remarkable, and the Republican losses in Mississippi and Georgia concerning. The less visible races are as much of a concern as the most visible races, Ayers said. Democrats are giving a particularly close look to the upset in Georgia, where they managed to flip two seats on the Georgia Public Service Commission, which oversees the Georgia Power Company. Democrats Peter Hubbard and Alicia Johnson both won with more than 60% of the vote. Party leaders see the results as a sign that the cost of utilities has emerged as one of the most salient issues for voters. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, home electricity bills rose 6.1% from August 2024 to August 2025. But a widespread Trump backlash is also part of the story. Exit polling suggests Trump dragged down Republicans in multiple races. In New Jersey, 97% of voters who voted for Sherrill said their vote was to oppose Trump, according to NBC exit polling. a year after Kamala Harris carried the state by 6 points, Cheryl won it by 13. Another GOP strategy appears to be tying Democrats to Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist set to be New York City's next mayor. Mamdani drew more than 1 million votes in a campaign focused on hiking taxes on the wealthy to pay to make child care, rent, and transportation more affordable. Democratic leaders say the results show the party does best when candidates reflect the local electorate, pointing to the moderate campaigns of Spanberger and Cheryl. In her victory speech as Virginia's first woman elected governor, Spanberger delivered lines that Democrats will likely echo the next 12 months. "We chose our commonwealth over chaos," Spanberger said. "You all chose leadership that will focus relentlessly on what matters most: lowering costs, keeping our communities safe, strengthening our economy for every Virginian. Leadership that will focus on problem solving, not stoking division." And that article was briefly abridged. The tragic of Eric Adams, this is a long article that I will shorten, and it is under the banner politics. The tragedy of Eric Adams, a day in the city with the mayor of New York, that is now the former mayor of New York, by Molly Ball. Before Eric Adams can start explaining the conspiracy that took him down, the former mayor of New York City must make his morning smoothie. On a chilly recent Friday, he's standing in the stainless steel kitchen of Gracie Mansion, the stately official residence on the Upper East Side, layering blueberries and ginger and flaxseed and greens into a Nutribullet blender. "Some people think that our stomachs are like a washing machine, that when you eat, everything mixes up together, and it's not," he says, pouring the mixture into a greenish-brown sludge. "Our stomachs are like a sink where what you put in at first goes down the drain first." He pours me a sample. "It tastes like ginger-flavored grass." We are speaking a week and change since Adams bowed to the inevitable and dropped his bid for re-election. There's a lot he wants to get off his chest. When he was elected 4 years ago, Adams seemed poised to be a transformational figure. Amid rising crime and racial tensions, the former police captain promised there need be no compromise between safety and justice. Like Joe Biden's election a year earlier, his win was a triumph of the Democratic Party's moderate black base over the radical chic faculty liberals and their alienating ideas. "I'm the Biden of Brooklyn," Adams boasted. "Look at me and you're seeing the future of the Democratic Party." Aides whispered that he could run for president. 4 years later, the Democrats' future looks murkier than ever, and Adams' lofty ambitions lie in ruins. His approval rating sank as low as 20% in the wake of his federal indictment on bribery and corruption charges and its subsequent dismissal by President Trump's Justice Department. In the mayoral race between Zohran Mamdani and Andrew Cuomo, Adams was relegated to an afterthought, an object of ridicule and scorn. The cloud of scandal has obscured the message he wants to leave on his way out. "I could have made better choices," he says, reflecting on all the appointees who broke the rules and betrayed him. "But I had a city to run. And when you look at it, even with the crew that I assembled, there was not 1 year that we were not moving the city forward." He's been punished, as he sees it, for telling unpopular truths, harassed by an unfair justice system, hammered by a biased press, his achievements diminished by a system he threatened. It's hard not to think about what might have been. It strikes me as Shakespearean in its tragic outcome, because there was so much there to admire, says Juan Williams, the Fox News analyst who's known Adams since the 1990s, when Playboy assigned him to write a profile of the young lieutenant who had risked his career to testify about racism in the NYPD. There was so much energy and determination, Williams recalls, a sense that this guy's going somewhere and going to take other people with him, especially black people. But I don't think there's any question it's his fault. He was selfish, and it clouded his thinking, his sense of right and wrong. Adams grabs the smoothie and his suit jacket and climbs into the back of the black Suburban that is his de facto office. There's a packed day ahead. The next 12 hours will take us to 10 stops across three of the city's five boroughs, from a rundown police precinct to a glitzy nightclub, from a subway platform to a taxi driver's gala. The indictment's on Adams' mind as we make our way to City Hall. No gold bars, no bags of cash, nothing. The case was about upgrades, he says, of the bribery charges. Over years of investigating me, they could never find anything, so they had to concoct this. Adams was born in Brooklyn and moved to Queens in elementary school. By his teens, he was a street hustler affiliated with a local crew. At 15, he was arrested with his brother after being caught stealing. In police custody, officers repeatedly kicked the brothers in the groin, according to Adams, leaving him urinating blood. The encounter left Adams' brother with a hatred of cops, but it motivated Eric to become one. In 22 years on the force, he became known as an outspoken internal critic. Adams left the NYPD and ran for state senate in 2006, where one of his first causes was pay raises for lawmakers. "Show me the money," he said in a floor speech. He served four terms before being elected the first black Brooklyn borough president in 2013. In 2020, he joined a crowded Democratic mayoral primary that included tech executive Andrew Yang and several liberal technocrats. Adams' focus on public safety stood out. His upset victory, powered by outer borough black voters, signaled that the party's working-class silent majority wanted more and better policing, not the defund the police of the fashionable activist slogan. Under Adams, the city saw a decline in both violent and property crimes. Shootings were down 54% and murders down 36% last year, compared with the same period 4 years ago, according to NYPD. Subway crime in the third quarter of 2025 was lowest in recorded history, excluding the pandemic. And crime isn't the only area where Adams' accomplishments have been substantial, says Catherine Wild, president of the Powerful Partnership for New York City, who's worked with mayors since the 1970s. Adams cut billions from the budget and took on entrenched urban nonprofits, weathering criticism from homelessness advocates when he ramped up the city's use of involuntary commitment for those with severe mental illness, a policy Mamdani vowed to roll back. His chief of staff, Camille Joseph Varlock, tells me Adams has a skepticism of government grounded in his upbringing. He feels the city failed his family, and that drives him in a way I don't know if he even understands, she says. I tell him, I always think of you as Batman, and not just because you like to go out at night. We pass the flashing screens of Times Square and descend the steps to its subway station, where a dozen reporters and a row of television cameras await. Adams, as is his custom for even the most banal announcement, enters to the strains of Jay-Z's Empire State of Mind. The press conference begins normally enough. Adams and his well-respected police commissioner, Jessica Tisch, tout the program they've instituted to reduce crime and homelessness on the subway, which they say has removed 2,100 people for quality of life violations and connected thousands with shelter beds and permanent housing. It's when the reporters start asking questions that things start to go off the rails. One asks about the latest gruesome subway crime. A 64-year-old man beaten to death at a Brooklyn station. Another asks if Adams' campaign failed because his claims of progress were not convincing. Perhaps, a reporter suggests, there are shootings not being recorded in official statistics. Tisch takes this one. If the suggestion is that we're in some way hiding people with bullet holes in them, I think that's absurd, she says. Adams points a finger at his least favorite reporter, Chris Sommerfeld of the Daily News, whom he banned from City Hall press conferences. In the paper, Sommerfeld has a story about political humanity, a new memoir self-published by Adams' former girlfriend, Jasmine Ray, who later worked in his administration. Their relationship first turned romantic, according to the book, at a 2014 encounter at Brooklyn Borough Hall. Adams takes issue with Sommerfeld's description of this as the first time she slept with Adams. The book strongly implies it, but Ray tells me they merely kissed. You are a dark, sick person, man, Adams says, glaring at Sommerfeld. Tisch and some of the other officials are starting to look uncomfortable. He dismisses them. Y'all can depart. Let me do this. A prolonged diatribe at Sommerfeld ensues. He turns on his heel, exuding the calm of a man whose anger has escaped his body. The small crowd that has gathered on the other side of the turnstiles breaks into a mix of heckling and applause. As Adams strides back up the subway steps to his waiting car, a voice calls out behind him, "Would you take the upgrades again, Mr. Mayor?" Adams settles into the back seat, turns to me and grins. "For the next 3 months," he says, "I'm going to have so much fun." To hear Adams' critics tell it, the mayor was not a victim, but a serial offender. A machine Paul on the make who was never really vetted before he won the keys to the city in a stroke of lucky timing. Adams was repeatedly investigated for alleged ethical lapses before his mayoral election. Once in office, he surrounded himself with cronies, many of whom were quickly enmeshed in scandal. In 2021, I warned people he would be corrupt and there would be chaos, and unfortunately I was right, says Curtis Sliwa, the Republican who ran against Adams 4 years ago and is once again the GOP nominee last fall. He's the most corrupt mayor in the history of New York City, and that's saying a lot. He created his own destruction, but like every politician, he can never acknowledge it, can never apologize. It's always a conspiracy. By the time Adams was indicted, dozens of city officials had resigned or been fired. Many had themselves been indicted for allegedly selling contracts and trading favors. In October 2024, a New York Magazine cover blared, "Last one out of City Hall, turn out the lights." It's a testament to either Adams' governance or New York's vast and competent bureaucracy that the city continued to function smoothly as members of the mayor's cabinet fell like dominoes. Adams is vague about what he's going to do next, back at Gracie, as he microwaves a vegan dinner for one, a lentil-based pasta and medley of vegetables smothered with nutritional yeast. He tells me he'd like to travel the world and work in the private sector. In recent days, he regaled the city press corps with talk of a book, a documentary, a PhD he wants to pursue. The political-industrial complex is now in control, and they don't need the Eric Adamses of the world. He wasn't from Harvard, wasn't from Yale, he was from the streets. He was held to a different standard in many ways. He never had a shot. The Democratic strategists who've chewed over their parties on popularity in memo after memo since last November pined for an authentic tribune of the working class, a candidate who plays to the middle, someone who can sound tough on crime and immigration without being a malicious racist, someone who understands the aspirations of regular people, who can embody masculinity without disrespecting women or gay people, who can speak to the men, particularly young men of color, leaving the party in droves, someone who can work the system and deliver for the people. You had a mayor that was probably one of the finest mayors for working-class people, and the city turned against him, Adams says. But no one said it's supposed to be fair. This article was written by Molly Ball, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein. Legend returns. Inside Lindsey Vonn's, that's V-O-N-N, unprecedented attempt at an Olympic comeback. By Sean Gregory, Beverly Hills, California, and Park City, Utah. Lindsey Vonn lifts her middle finger in the Southern California sun. Vonn, the Olympic gold medal skier, all-time leader in World Cup downhill wins, and rare figure in her sport whose talent, charisma, and celebrity have transcended the snow-covered slopes, is hiking a canyon near her Beverly Hills home. Not so long ago, this might have seemed unfathomable, as she struggled with not just standard wear and tear that comes from decades of competing at a professional level, but also swelling and pain caused by numerous crashes while flying down mountains. Since her partial knee replacement surgery in the spring of 2024, however, Vonn, 41, has felt like a new person. The gesture, though, is not just one of defiance as she walks briskly on the somewhat hilly terrain. It is a message to her detractors. When Vonn launched a surprise comeback last year, after having been retired from the tour for 5 seasons, many fans cheered her return, but critics made themselves heard as well. They suggested her decision and goal of earning a spot atop the podium in Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy, at the 2026 Olympics, revealed an unfulfilling life and wondered why she'd even try such a thing at her age. Vonn was undeterred. Besides the faith she had in her newly restored knee and her unflagging work ethic, she had planted a little pep talk for herself years earlier. Before her last Olympics in 2018 in Pyeongchang, she got a tattoo on the middle finger of her right hand of the word believe in Greek, the language of the birthplace of the Olympic Games. Believing in myself has always been so important, says Vonn. Now it has probably never rang more true. And so, as she directs the digit at her doubters with an impish grin, she displays the word in all its glory. Then, for good measure, she does it again. As the world's best winter athletes gather in February for a celebration of speed, acrobatics, and artistry on snow and ice, Vonn's attempt to earn another Olympic medal will likely be the buzziest story of the Games. During her illustrious career, Vonn, a Minnesota native who learned to ski on a tiny hill south of the Twin Cities, won a record-tying 20 World Cup Crystal Globes, awarded annually to the best performer in the various disciplines of skiing, downhill, slalom, etc., plus the best all-round performer. She earned gold and bronze medals at the 2010 Vancouver Olympics, becoming the first U.S. woman to win gold in downhill, and her campaign to ski against men, which the sport's bigwigs denied, drove considerable attention. Before injuries got the best of her, she was on pace to pass the mark for all-time World Cup victories, 86, set by Ingemar Stenmark of Sweden. Instead, Vaughn won 82 times, and American Michaela Schifrin has since set a new record with 101 and counting. Vaughn's bionic quest will do nothing less than test the boundaries of human capabilities. No ski racer, male or female, has ever returned to the top level with titanium implanted onto the sport's central piece of hardware. With another Olympic medal, she would shatter the previous record for the oldest female alpine Olympic medalist, 33, Lindsey Vonn in Pyeongchang. Advances in sports science have allowed a host of high-profile male athletes to extend their greatness into middle age. Tom Brady won a Super Bowl at 43. Tiger Woods, whom Vaughn dated for nearly 3 years in the 2010s, victorious at the Masters at the same age. LeBron James still making all NBA teams at 40. Female examples, Vaughn notes, are harder to find. Since retiring from skiing in 2019, Vaughn has faced tribulations that made her arrival at this moment even more remarkable. And after some disappointing results in her 2024-2025 comeback season that left her questioning the efficacy of her endeavor, a second-place finish at the World Cup Finals in Sun Valley, Idaho, in March gave her momentum going into her upcoming campaign, which started December 12 in St. Moritz, Switzerland. "I am not a long shot," says Vaughn, during an expansive pre-hike conversation on her living room couch. "I am back in the game." Some 48 hours after what she thought would be her final ski race, a bronze medal downhill run at the 2019 World Championships in Åre, Sweden, Vaughn woke up in Nashville, where her boyfriend at the time, P.K. Subban, was playing for the NHL's Predators. She called her agents, ANSI, asking them to book something, anything, for her to do. They laughed. "The post-competition chill-out," says Mark Irvin, one of her reps, "did not last very long." Vaughn had first put on a pair of skis at age 3 and competed in her first race at 7. Without skiing, she struggled to find her identity. "I fell a pretty big hole," she says. "You don't want to get out of bed and you've got no drive." She'd felt depressed after prior ski injuries, especially the ACL tear during a November 2013 training crash that ultimately kept her out of the Sochi Olympics. Back then, however, she could at least look forward to returning to the mountain. "It was the one thing that really made me happy," says Vaughn. "When I retired, that first year was like, how do I get out of this funk? What is going to make me feel like I have a purpose?" It didn't help that her personal life was also undergoing upheaval. Vaughn and Subban, who got engaged in August 2019, split in December 2020. "I don't want to get too into the weeds on it," says Vaughn, "but I'm not the kind of person that is going to stay home and not work." Subban declined to comment. Fawn's friends have called her the most confident, unconfident person they know. And her new therapist, Armando Gonzalez, would spend days with her in her homes in Beverly Hills and Park City, Utah, talking through Fawn's adjustment to her new life. It's reckoning with some of these limiting self-beliefs that I would call lies, says Gonzalez, who spoke with Time with Fawn's permission. When you get to the root of them, they were plaguing her and limiting her in a lot of areas. She would need to remove them. Friends know Vaughn's feeling good psychically, and she's in a positive place, so she has inspired some certitude. In Cortina, Vaughn will likely compete in three events, the downhill, Super G, and the combined team competition. She's going to win one of them, if not more, says Pika Bo Street, who will be commentating for NBC. It's not a matter of if, it's when. And that lengthy article was abridged. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by the G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.